Hello, I'm Fred Stella, president of the Interfaith Dialogue Association. Welcome to another edition of Common Threads. You know, the last time we had a member of the LDS Church on our program, my goodness, a Mormon was not running for president. They did not have their own Broadway show. And a whole lot of other things have happened in the world of Latter-day Saints. And so we thought it was about that time to get somebody down here to talk about the Church of Jesus Christ Latter-day Saints. And we did. Garth Emmett is our guest today, and Garth is very active in the local stake, one of the local stakes here in West Michigan. He is an ordained high priest in the LDS Church. He's been living in Grand Rapids since 1982 and a lifetime member of the LDS. His father was a bishop. He served a two-year mission in Bordeaux, France, and he married at the LDS in Washington, D.C. at the temple. He's the father of five. He served in a variety of callings, including that of bishop, which is the equivalent of a pastor in the Wyoming-Michigan ward, and has also served at the Grand Rapids Stake High Council, which is the equivalent of a diocese here in West Michigan. And he served as a religion instructor for church education, both at the high school level and the college level. And he is also on the Interfaith Dialogue Association Speakers Bureau. And when people call us up, as they are wont to do, be they schools, colleges, churches outside of LDS, and they are looking for a Mormon speaker, Garth is the man that I call, and he has served very well in that capacity. So we want to welcome to Common Threads, Garth Emmett. Hello, Garth.
Hello. Thank you, Fred.
You are also a chiropractor.
I am. That's how I earn my living, because the church pays just in blessings.
Yes. That is something I'm quite aware of.
Right.
And from what I understand, you have no problem getting people to serve in capacities such as bishop or high priest or anything. People really love to serve the church, and they get no remuneration.
Correct. Right. Yeah, I don't think there's been a problem. I mean, there's obviously going to be an occasional person who declines for whatever reason, health or maybe a job problem, something like that.
But it's not the fact that there's no compensation.
People no.
People don't say, well, geez, I thank you for asking me to be a high priest.
What does it pay? Yeah. No. No, in fact, I don't think anyone would even have that cross their mind if they've been in the church for very long. It's just not the way we operate.
But there have to be certain, like, clerical jobs, office jobs. Really?
Well, if someone is in full-time church employment—
That's what I mean.
Yeah. Say, for example, the church has some universities, Brigham Young University.
Yes.
Obviously, you know, that's not a volunteer basis. That's your career.
Right.
But even in the church educational system, or bishops who put in, you know, like any pastor, a bunch of hours, there's no remuneration for that whatsoever. It's just voluntary. We take our turn. When someone's called as a bishop, there's probably as many condolence pats on the back as there are congratulatory pats on the back. So, yeah, it's just kind of considered responsible duty, discipleship.
And this is not permanent?
No calling in the church, or very few callings in the church, I'd say, are permanent. Even missionaries, it's a two-year for men and a year and a half for women. Bishops, they serve at the pleasure of, you know, the congregation as well as the authorities above them. But it's usually 5 years, 6 years as a bishop. So, you know, there is a light at the end of the service tunnel. And by light, I mean you go into a different service position. It's not that there's retirement. I suppose if someone's health gets to the point where they're no longer capable, that's a whole different category. But yeah, probably the only exception is our general authorities, apostles, for example. That's a lifetime calling. They retire by dying.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Other than that, though, everybody else, you do get an out.
And what if you really, really love what you're doing and you don't want to leave that position? Is there any option to petition the powers that be to say, no, can I just do another couple of years?
I suppose one could suggest that. Mm-hmm. I think it would probably be very rare, because since we believe you are called by inspiration, we also believe that you are released by inspiration. So I have had callings I've really enjoyed and was disappointed when I was, you know, released. But it would never be considered probably the norm for someone to say, you know, I'd really like to keep this calling. Mm-hmm. Now, that doesn't mean you can't have a conversation, you know, and say, well, you know, have you considered this? But yeah, usually we're willing to move on.
And when you were relieved of your calling, you knew when that was going to happen, more or less. Am I correct?
Just in the case of Bishop, I knew I had served my 5 years, and that's the typical spate of time. I've known some bishops that have served 10 years or have been put back into a bishopric in either their own unit or some other, you know, parish two or three times. So it's not that you may not revisit a calling, but yeah, in my case, I got a call about 2 weeks before the release saying, Bishop, we're going to be releasing you in 2 weeks. And then I have a release interview, and I don't want to say train, but I meet with the incoming bishop, mm-hmm, and fill him in on where I'm at, and we go from there.
Mm. And how was your missionary time in France?
I was going to say I thoroughly enjoyed it, but it was a lot of work.
You had to learn French, I'm assuming?
Had to learn French. Most missionaries all missionaries going to a foreign language mission will spend 2 months in what we call a mission training center. In my day, it was called a language training mission, but now it's called the MTC, Mission Training Center. I think there's a half dozen to a dozen or so around the world. The biggest one is associated with Brigham Young University. And what's amazing is your second day there, you are asked to only speak in your native tongue, which, of course, you don't know yet. So you carry a dictionary around, and you're assigned a companion, and you're put in a district of other French missionaries, in my case, or Chinese or Japanese, whatever. And it's very intensive. You rise at 6 in the morning, eat. By 7, you start your first class. No, I guess by 8, because you do have some personal study time, breakfast. By 8 o'clock, you start your first class. That goes to lunch. You have a regular lunch hour, and then you start more classes. And it's a combination of, I guess you'd say, missionary-type training. What will it be like on your mission, and spiritual aspects and scriptural study? And then I'd say the majority for a foreign missionary is language. So you learn in 2 months, I'd say the equivalent of probably a 2-3 year college course.
Seriously?
Oh, yeah. It's very intense. You go till 9 at night, all in language studies. The classes, by the way, are taught by former returned missionaries who usually are at, in the case where I was, Brigham Young University. And after 2 months, you really feel that you know the language until you arrive in the country.
Yeah.
And then you suddenly realize, wait a minute, where did they send me? This is not – and in my case, just a small moment here, I was sent to southern France.
Now, imagine, I've been to Bordeaux.
Oh, yes.
Lovely
well,
city.
I first arrived in a little town called Carcassonne,
uh-huh,
and my companion – it was a two-missionary town, just he and I, and he was not at the train station when I arrived. And so I asked a nun who happened to be standing nearby, pretty safe, to talk to a nun. And I said, excusez-moi, madame, sœur, I might have said, which means sister. And I asked her, can you tell me where this address is? And she spoke in what I thought was Spanish. I found out later that southern France would be like dropping an Oxford-trained English student in Georgia. They have a very heavy southern accent, which I did not I did not know about that. So suddenly you're there, and they're rattling off an address and pointing, and I just kind of walked where she was pointing, and luckily it was like two streets over, so everything worked out. But yeah, I'm sure other missionaries have had similar experiences.
If you're like me, when I go to Italy, you know, I'm Italian-American. I don't speak fluent Italian, but I can get by. And I've had actually very deep philosophical and political conversations in Italian, but getting directions? only slightly worse, of course, than when I get directions in English.
Right. Well, that might be the left side, right side brain function that we maybe all have. But yeah, but you know, after you're in country, I'd say within 3 to 4 months, you realize how much you didn't know from the MTC. And then you begin to dream in French, and everything you do is in French.
Oh, yeah. How long did it take you to start dreaming in French? Well, without subtitles.
Without subtitles. Well, I think to be really good, I can remember it sounded initially like a string of syllables. And the problem in any foreign language is they're speaking as we are now in our regular speed and you know, the syntax of the language, which they can't teach you very well in a you know, noun, pronoun kind of class situation. So I'd say it probably took about 3 or 4 months to start actually separating the syllables, and then about 6 months until I really felt I could pretty much handle anything. And then after 2 years, yeah, you're probably Frenchified or
oh, sure.
Japaneseified or Germanified or whatever. So then when you come home, you got to remember where your English pronouns and adjectives go, because it takes a little while. So that's one reason I think that missions are designed to be a short term. 2 years, at the end of your mission, you may want to stay, but there again, you don't get that opportunity. Maybe an extension to match your parents' vacationing hours so they can, you know, meet you in Toulouse or something. But short of that, you're done. You come home, you're supposed to, and we do, go back to college, get your career, get married, have children, and then you support your local ward.
And how's your French today? Just curious.
Well, I rent French movies from time to time. And what I find is it's gotten rusty. If the speaker in the movie is facing the camera, I do pretty well. If their back's to me and there's two or three people bantering back and forth, I have to read the subtitles. Because it's been, I got home in 1977, so, you know, it's been a few years.
Sure.
But I do try to keep it up. I still read some French journals and books and things like that.
It's a wise thing to do. It really is.
And it is a beautiful language.
Yes. Yes, it is. So one of the reasons I had you here today, Garth, is to talk about the LDS Church today and the things that you may have seen, the changes that you may have seen, including what is called by, I don't know if you would use this term in the church, but others are calling it a new openness. So one of the things I'm curious about, the whole idea of being a missionary. Now let's define what a missionary is, because, you know, if you're talking to, say, a Baptist missionary, they might be talking about going out in the jungle and starting a school or something like that. But am I correct in saying the definition of a missionary in Mormon terms is to go door to door?
Well, a proselyting missionary, yes, that would be true. But we have other missionaries as well. We have health missionaries. We have agricultural missionaries. We have missionaries who actually go out and gather records. We have genealogical missionaries that try to amass the records from various parts of the world before they're lost. Mm-hmm. So health missionaries, we have senior missionaries, there's a wide variety of missionaries. The majority would certainly be proselyting, but even proselyting missionaries are not defined as only proselyting. They are assigned service hours. Their job in every city in which they dwell is to find a way that they can literally serve. Soup kitchens, sometimes not even in our faith. They may volunteer at a school as tutors to help. Or in my mission, we found there was a need for or at least a desire among the French to learn English. So we offered English classes. We didn't even bring up that we were missionaries. It was totally free, which they liked. Mm-hmm. So they could come every Wednesday night, and we would have an hour-long English instruction. We actually had a local airport that was training pilots, and they wanted us to come, and they wanted to pay us. And we said, well, we actually can't take any money as missionaries. But so we went out to the air school there and taught their pilots English, just as a way to be of service. So being of service is a big part of being a missionary. When I was a missionary, and I don't think the policy has changed, we were asked to work 60 hours a week, and that meant outside of your apartment. Most of that would be proselyting. Mm-hmm. A portion of it is supporting the local members, meeting their needs. Certainly that would include helping build chapels and throwing in your elbow grease to whatever projects were needed. And in fact, that I'll just jump to the side a minute. That continues in the local congregations too. We actually have service hours that the members are asked to fulfill. It used to be, it's less so now, but it used to be that every stake had a farm or a some project. Sometimes they were cattle farms or cornfields or whatever. The church actually owned those, and then they paid no one for the work. The work was supplied by the members, and each ward or each branch or each group was assigned a certain number of hours, and we still are. We have canneries. The Mormons raise a tremendous amount of welfare food that then's used in our bishop storehouses, which is a whole other topic we can chat mm-hmm. about. But so the Mormons have always believed in service, and missionaries, while their main proselyting missionary's goal is to proselyte, it's not just one aspect.
Okay. I appreciate that. If you're just joining us, you're listening to WGVU's Common Threads. I'm Fred Stella. Garth Amit is our guest today. We're talking about Mormonism. So now that we know this, and I really appreciate you expounding on what a missionary is, but the proselytizing part of it, going door to door,
yes,
and beginning conversations with people, is that so foundational to the faith that you couldn't rethink it and say, you know, times are different, we have the internet, we have all this technology, is this the most efficient? And could somebody come up and say, you know, maybe we should do things different? Or is that, again, so foundational that it would be trying to take confession out of the Catholic Church?
Mm. Well, that's a good question. I think the church does both. The church media, I don't think there's probably an American that hasn't seen a Mormon commercial on TV. Mm-hmm. Most of those are not geared towards proselyting. They're simply geared to build your family, you know, spend time at home. Love your children, those kinds of messages. But I don't think that it's so much that it's written in stone as to the policies and methods. In fact, they recently changed. For many, many, many years, the church, males in the church, as almost a rite of passage, would leave usually at the age of 19. They could leave up to the age of 25. And after that, if you didn't leave by 25, because it's a two-year commitment, then you weren't going to be invited to serve a mission. Young women, just because there's higher risks in some cultures, would be able to serve starting at the age of 21. Just in the last, I'd say year and a half, the church lowered those ages. So now young men leave at 18 or can leave at 18. Young women can leave at 19. So we've gone from about 50,000 missionaries, which was kind of a plateau that had been there since I was a missionary, and currently there's 85,000 missionaries that are out serving. And part of that is just because they realize that, well, if a boy can't leave till 19, he'll have just enough time after high school to start college, and then he has to stop. How's that going to work with scholarships? How's that going to work with a program that he's already admitted into? And wouldn't it make more sense if they left at 18, right out of high school, most of the time, and then they could come back and start their college. They'd be 2 years older and wiser. Frankly, a lot of 2 years of freshman and sophomore years are kind of wasted anyway, because they're partying and, you know, Mormon youth hopefully less. But this gives them the opportunity now to come back and not have an interruption in their schooling. So that's a major change. And as I said, it immediately jumped the numbers a good 30,000. So the mission program changes all the time. When I was a missionary, we learned rote missionary discussions in French, and nobody ever used them, but you had to memorize them and pass them off. That's gone now. The missionary work is believed, you know, hey, if it's supposed to be directed by the Spirit, why are we memorizing the dialogue? Let's free that up, and let's just make sure the missionaries have the concepts, and then they teach it any way they want. So it is an evolving, I would say, constantly changing practice. But the actual use of missionaries, I don't think will ever change. It's a boots on the ground. You got to get your, you know, hands in the mud. And frankly, if you walked into probably any Mormon congregation, a sidebar benefit of having all these people who've served missions, men and women, is you could probably say, how many here speak a foreign language? And you'd probably have 20 to 25% of the congregation raise their hands. And that doesn't mean that that's all that served on the mission, but the rest stayed in an English-speaking country.
Sure.
So we have missionaries in my ward who've been to China, Russia, and it opens your eyes. In fact, you mentioned the Book of Mormon play on Broadway or musical on Broadway, which I haven't seen because I haven't been to New York, although I hear it's coming to Grand Rapids. And I probably will go see it, although I hear it has its negatives
naughty
too.
Bits.
It's naughty bits too. But I think they bring that out, that these innocent young people dropped out of, you know, the heartland of America suddenly confront war scenes and, you know, terrible, terrible things, which I saw too, even in France. And you're dealing with the everyday citizen in ways that you've never encountered before. Mitt Romney, not that I know him personally, but I understand on his mission he met and dealt with all kinds of people in every strata of French economy. And, you know, he suffered things and he endured things as all missionaries do. You are dog bone tired after you've worked 60 hours a week and done service among those hours. It's an exhausting experience.
Oh, I am, absolutely. And yeah. When I was talking about changing, the possibility of changing, I was speaking specifically of door-to-door, specifically that. How successful is it?
It's never been the best way to proselyte. When you knock on someone's door, you're catching them in the middle of their dinner. And so, yeah, I would say we try to stay away from door-to-door. Not that it isn't
still done.
Well, you do. Yeah, the typical missionary is taught how to not do door-to-door. Yes, you still have to do it. There's going to be open hours. But we believe that the best way to teach the gospel is to have members and missionaries work together. So along with our full-time missionaries, we have a saying in the church, every Mormon knows it, which is every member a missionary. We have every ward has a ward mission leader. The ward mission leader has local ward missionaries that serve just, you know, in their spare time. They dovetail their efforts with the full-time missionaries so that the full-time missionaries aren't, I don't want to say wasting, but let's say in non-productive door knocking, how many empty doors and people who can't speak to you or don't want to. So yeah, we do try to avoid, frankly, door knocking. I don't think every missionary knows where I live, but I've only had the missionaries knock on my door maybe once or twice in 30 years, and it's not because they all know where I am either.
I can't remember the last time that I had somebody knock on my door.
Well, I'll send them your way. That sounds like an invitation to me.
No, I really thought that it was very consistent. Perhaps it is still is with the Jehovah's Witnesses. Perhaps they, I believe they are still extremely focused on door-to-door. And I thought you were, which is my
mistake. And I would say it depends on where you're serving. If you're in a little town where there's, you know, eight members of the church in a town of 50,000, which is kind of what it was when I was a missionary in Carcassonne, a town of 50,000, and we had maybe 16 members. Oh, yeah, most of our time was door knocking. But that's not the goal. That's not the ideal.
Have you found out what really is the most effective way to bring people into the church? At least, maybe not to fully convert, but at least to introduce them, the people who are seeking, and you're on their list of people to try out.
Well, I think the most efficient way is just as in any organization that wants to promote itself, it's by living the gospel. I know more people who have joined the church because they worked with a Mormon and they admired their work ethic, their personal code of life. I've often said to my evangelical friends, if you stood I'm going to say quintessential, typical, believing, faithful evangelical next to his counterpart in the Mormon church, you would not tell them apart. And so just as the evangelical church, I think, has the greatest success by its members, you know, by their fruits you shall know them. Mm-hmm. I think the Mormons do too. Now, as far as how does that translate to, you know, actually sitting down and teaching someone, I'm not sure if there is a single method. It's probably members first, members inviting their friends and family to, hey, if you're looking for something in your life or there's something I can help you with. But let me emphasize that we think people of all good faiths or of no faith have just the same chance and shot at heaven as any devout Mormon, which we can talk about too. It's a little separate ideology.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
When you go to work now, and I'm sorry, how are you serving? Are you serving at this time?
Right. Currently I am. Since I left being bishop, I asked, and again, it's not normally one does that. I'm not recommending my ward members take this as a carte blanche, go ahead and do it yourself. But after serving as bishop, The stake president hinted that they'd probably like to move me back into the high council because I've had experience now as bishop and I'm counseling other bishops. I said, you know, I'd really like to be in the primary. That's the children ages 3 to 11. Mm-hmm. I said, I just would like to be able to do that. So he said, okay, fine. So I spent the next 2 years as a 9-year-old primary teacher, teaching and then singing time and gathering time and doing all the things that little kids do. And that was a blast. I enjoyed it. Then I was called to serve in the Sunday school and to teach some classes there, and though it's more adult age and teenage age. And currently, and just a month ago, I was asked to and released again to serve as a member of the High Priest Group presidency, so or group leader. So our job now is to basically help direct the adult members of the church with a particular focus on the ages 50 and up, which I'm in. I'm 59, so...
Okay, wonderful. Yeah. We are out of time for today's episode, Garth, but I appreciate the conversation. Would love to have you back next week, and we can chat more.
Be glad to be here.
You've been listening to Common Threads here on WGVU. I'm Fred Stella. With me today has been Garth Amit, and he is very active in the local Mormon community. And we're going to continue to talk about the LDS next week right here on WGVU.